Coming to you from Toronto, Canada, this is Classic Camera Revival. If you don't have gear acquisition syndrome now, you certainly will after listening to this show.
Hey everybody, it's March 2015 and coming to you live from Meadow Studio in Toronto, Canada, this is Classic Camera Revival. I'm Alex Laux.
I'm Mike Bataxi.
I'm Donna Bataxi.
And I'm John Meadows.
We hope you had a great March break, because we're here to give you more gas.
Hey guys, today's topic is rangefinder cameras. Now, these are cameras that are highly favored by street photographers, and you come up with names like Leica, which, unless it's an old screw mount body, none of us can really afford for it at this time.
Leica is German for expensive.
Yes. So, we're going to bring up some camera bodies that are a little more within an average film photographer's budget range. So I'm going to kick it off with the Minolta HiMatic 7S. This is a fixed lens rangefinder with an absolutely gorgeous 45mm f1.7 fixed lens. You can't change it. Now the 7S has a very special spot for me because it was my first camera.
Nice.
And relatively unknown on the market. The HiMatic series is actually really nice. You really want to avoid some of the later models. They got more point-and-shoot as the years went on. But the 7S is a true rangefinder. And it does take a battery to run it in automatic mode, which my battery has since died. It's an old Mercury cell. And I've tried it with an alkaline, and it actually doesn't work at all, which is weird.
That is really odd.
But I can run it mechanically. So I either use an external meter, or I use my phone with a light meter app, or I simply use a Sunny 16.
Sunny 16 works.
Rule. And it's a solid camera. It's easy to use. It's nice. It's heavy. It feels good in my hand. And for me, as someone just getting started in photography, when I first got it, it cost me $5 at a garage sale. And it's done me well ever since. It's been dropped. I've had to repair the hot shoe on occasion, and again, it's solid, it's mechanical, it will run anything, anywhere, anytime. I've never actually tried using it for street photography, but again, for a simple snapshot camera, it made it really easy to get to know film, get to know composition, and I mean, learning on an SLR, you're looking right through the lens, so I'm already kicking it up a notch by learning how to correct for having the viewfinder off to one side. Focus is accurate. Lens is sharp. I mean, you can't go wrong with Minolta glass. Like Olympus, they weren't exactly the major players in the show, but they produced a quality product and quality lens.
Yeah, their lenses were really darn good. I mean,
yep.
I found when it came to Minolta, their lenses, tack sharp. Cameras, yep. Not so much, but hey.
Well, like any, Minolta went plastic very quickly.
Yeah.
And especially with their autofocus line, but their early manual focus stuff, I really have no complaints over. I stuck with Minolta for years. It only really wasn't until 2006 that I switched over to Nikon. Before that, I was Minolta all the way, and was actually going to consider going into digital and modern SLRs. But when they sold it to Sony, I picked up the first Sony Alpha body and went, nope.
Well, there was also the, the Minolta 7? I think that was their, was that their DSLR? The Minolta 7? Or just that,
was the 7D was there, right.
Yeah, I heard actually really good things on that camera. Mm-hmm. But no, it's sad when they, well, not sad per se that it was upsetting when they sold to Sony. I mean, things like that are inevitable in the market, but
exactly.
It's too bad that Sony's cameras were not quite what you think of when it comes to an SLR,
exactly.
Unfortunately.
And control layout, everything's on the lens body. So you got your shutter speed and your aperture right there. So again, it's just a simple, small movement and a nice lug for focusing.
Oh, very nice.
And the contrast on the focusing window, nice and sharp. It hasn't faded at all.
Oh, good.
Hey, cameras like that, you know, the Canical ones, like one of the Canonet series, or like the Ashika ones, are often a very expensive way to get into some very, very good glass. Like
yes.
For the fixed lens ones.
Yeah. Okay, Mike.
Okay. What do you have? So, I have a Kodak 35, which is the rangefinder model of the exact same camera. Now, I picked this one. I have a Kodak Signet 35. I'll give a brief little blurb on that. And, I mean, it's miles better than the Kodak 35 just in looks alone. I mean,
that thing looks like it's out of a early 1950s science fiction movie.
Well, that wouldn't
go Borg.
I wouldn't be surprised, yeah, exactly, if this was Borg. ever from a 1950s movie. I mean, this camera I have in my hand right now is from 1949, according to the Camerosity code. If anybody knows the Camerosity code, it's very simple to decode. Just Google it and you'll easily find the code on it. It's just basically first two letters is how you get the date. Yeah. Anyway, this
we'll
one
make sure they're the link in the show notes.
This one here, 1949, has shutter speeds all in the old style. So we start at 1/10th through to 1/200th of a second. And you have the timed mode and bulb exposure. Aperture ranges anywhere from 3.5 up to f/16, and that's with modern f-stop, so we're not talking about doubling and having to figure out what the heck the doubling means. Now, the one thing I find about this camera is it has two viewfinders. It's got the rangefinder window, which uses the old style military type rangefinder, which is the split instead of two images interposing. So you've got one image on top that is what you're looking at, and you've got the image on the bottom, which as you focus lines up with the other image. So the other thing is, when you use this camera, you cannot cock the shutter without film. So without film, a lot of people say, nope, sorry, camera doesn't work, can't get the shutter to fire, it's stuck. Well, believe it or not, without film, the camera will not work. But there is a way to test it. If you open up the back, you can see the sprocket counter wheel. If you push the release button to advance to the next frame, you can turn that wheel, and that will cock the shutter, test it. If it clicks and you see the shutter open and close, camera works. And that's all she wrote. Really, really basic. There's not much on it. So, hey, it's got a decently sharp lens, well-coated. I mean, let's face it. The camera was used to shoot Kodachrome. So anybody knows Kodachrome knows that the colors on it are forever. Almost like diamonds. But this definitely, no, it's not a diamond.
It's fun. This camera, it's, if you ever see like a list of like ugliest cameras of all time, this camera is always in the top five.
Definitely.
Because it's basically the original Kodak 35 was a scale focus, just a viewfinder, and so Kodak felt they needed to basically bolt on a rangefinder, but they just sort of basically bolted it on the outside, and so it looks very haphazard.
Yeah. Now,
that's the word I'd use.
I kind of like it.
Oh yeah.
It has a very unique look.
I don't think it's ugly at all.
Very, very unique. Mm-hmm. Now, speaking of which, that's actually one of the reasons why I brought this camera is because when I look at it, I can see why they went to the newer model. When they went to the Kodak Signet model, I understood what they did, why they did it. So, as I was saying, the Signet 35 is designed very much for using in the military. And in the military, they either use gloves or stuff like that. So with the Signet 35, it used a ball bearing focusing mechanism on it. Had very, very similar shutter speeds, except it, instead of 1/10th, it started at 1/25th and went up to 1/300th, which explains why it has a Supermatic 300 shutter. The rangefinder, instead of using the military style, used the newer style, the image on image. And one of the things I've heard them talk about on other various podcasts, I've heard in forums, is that the rangefinder is dim. And I've made a suggestion to several people. Take a piece of acetate, such as C41 film. Okay. Put it over your viewfinder, not on the rangefinder side, but the viewfinder side that you look straight through. That darkens it just enough that you will be able to see the okay. superimposed image.
Would something like lighting gel work?
Lighting gel will work, okay. absolutely. Now, the one thing that stands apart from the Kodak Signet 35 to any other Kodak Signet line is the lens. There is nothing on the market of that year or even in subsequent years that I will tell you right now that will match the Ektar lens. Mm. It is unreal how sharp that lens is. And if anybody's ever used an Ektar lens, they know that I'm talking
truth. Say no more,
truth.
Say no more.
Those golden words.
Yep.
I mean, when you're considering that Kodak's Ektar film is as good as it is, there's a reason why it's called Ektar.
Yep.
So if you get a chance to try out a Signet 35, by all means, do it. You will not regret it. They are fantastic cameras. If you find the focusing is a little bit stiff, that's okay. The ball bearing, it's all a sealed unit. You can take a tiny drop of gun oil, which is available in all markets around the world. Mm-hmm. Put a tiny drop on both sides of the focusing. Just focus in and out, and you will find it just loosens up beautifully, and that's nice. It. It's very simple. Aligning the rangefinder is simple. And you know what? You can say that you have a red dot camera for a lot less.
Well played, sir.
Nice. Okay, we're back, and we're going to the other German line that actually has nothing to do with Germany.
Yes. The Voigtlander name goes back to almost the dawn of photography. And my first good camera that I got to use, I still have, was my father's Voigtlander Vito B, which is a 35mm film camera from the 1956... Okay. 58. It's a scale focus only, and that camera still runs beautifully today. It's a beautiful precision mechanism. Mm-hmm. So fast forward to like the Voigtlander, some bad business decisions, there's bad management, and I guess the passing of time, went belly up. They did some really bad SLRs that were like crap.
Their meter doesn't work.
And the name ended up belonging to Zeiss, but then Zeiss licensed the name to the Japanese company Casina, and starting in the early 1990s, they created a range of rangefinder cameras that they're known for two things. First of all, they're quite affordable, all things considered, mm-hmm. and they also support Leica lenses. Now, I'm going to talk about the first one. This is the Voigtlander Besse R, and it's a 35mm rangefinder camera. What's interesting is that the lens mount is the Leica screw mount, the 39mm screw mount. To put it in perspective, the last time Leica made a screw mount rangefinder camera was the Leica 3G, which dates back to about 1957, mm-hmm. 1958, mm-hmm. because at that time, Leica had switched over to the M series, and M stands for money. And
the M series are a bayonet mount lens.
Yes, as opposed to a screw mount lens.
And they stab you in the wallet.
Exactly. I like that. That's a file for future reference. What the Voigtlander R represented was a body that has, you know, a beautiful viewfinder, mm-hmm. as good as the newer.
Oh yeah.
The newer Leicas, and it also has through the lens metering, and so like if you had, let's say if you had Leica screw mount lenses. Up until this camera came out, you had no options, basically, unless there's some Russian camera, for through-the-lens metering. The old screw-mount Leicas, I've got one here in my hand. Some people love them, some people hate them. Ergonomically, they take some getting used to. The viewfinder is nowhere near as good as it is on the R2. Now, I mentioned because the R2 takes the Leica screw mount lenses, you can use Leica lenses. They do say that if you're going to use any of the collapsible lenses, like an Elmar, you need to be very, very careful.
Or the Sumitar.
The Sumitar. Anything that collapses, you don't jam it in. Mm-hmm. You'd be very, very careful. Voigtlander or Cosina slash Voigtlander also made a number of lenses for this camera. Some that are really quite world beaters and very innovative. The first lens they made for the screw mount was a 15 millimeter super wide. I have it mounted on my Leica right here.
That's insanely wide.
And this is not 15 millimeter fisheye. This is 15 millimeter rectilinear, which means straight. And they've also made a 21 f4. They have a 35 2.5, which is the lens I have mounted on this camera. There is a 50 1.5, which I'd love to
get. That sounds like a Zeiss Sonner.
The 50 1.5, it's about $500 and wow. Up.
That's past the Zeiss Sonner price.
On the used market.
That's insanely priced, but that's great.
There's the 75mm 2.5. I'm probably missing a couple.
That's fine.
But a lot of good lenses. And as well, you know, you can also use Russian lenses on. And at some point in the future, we'll do an episode on Russian cameras. So I won't go too far into it. But just to say that with Russian lenses, the screw mount lenses, they will mount most of the time. But Russian gear, very well engineered, quality control, a bit spotty. Factor on buying two lenses to get one that works, and compatibility is not always perfect, but we'll go into that in the other episode. Right. But like today, if you shop around, you can get a body somewhere between $200 and $300.
Yep.
That's not bad.
And that's a very inexpensive way to get into this format, into a camera that is ergonomically modern and usable. I'd say that the viewfinder I mentioned is great. It has the frame lines for 50, 35, 90, and 75 millimeter lenses.
Nice.
For other lenses, you could use the a viewfinder. Shutter speeds from B up to 1/2000th of a second.
Nice.
Yeah, that beats Leica.
You don't get 1/2000th on a Leica. There are people in the past who said when it came out that it felt cheap or plasticky. Doesn't feel that way to me.
Not at all.
I love the feel of this camera. Ergonomically, it works with me. And I think we said the last episode, ergonomics is just so important. Mm-hmm. So I would give this, 5 stars.
Very nice.
Great.
I will add that they wanted to make the R2, R3, R3A, various other models, but those were all for the bayonet mount Leicas. Still very good cameras, but again, M stands for more money.
Yes.
Now, I can't help but notice that that also has a hot shoe.
Yes, this has a hot shoe. Leicas also were not known for their hot shoes in the screw mount series.
Mm-hmm. Nope, not at all.
No.
Last but not least,
Donna.
All right, today I chose the Olympus 35 SP. It was made in the late 1969, made by Olympus in Japan. It is the only 35mm rangefinder with a dual center weighted average metering and spot metering system.
Nice.
The metering is also available in manual mode, which is quite unusual amongst Japanese rangefinder cameras of this era. Unfortunately, mine is toast and no longer works, but it's still a great camera.
You can at least run it mechanically, I hope.
Mechanically, yes, absolutely.
You can. Yes. Perfect.
The Olympus 35 SP is without question the very best of the Olympus 35 rangefinder series. It features solid all-metal body with high-grade fit and finish. This camera is noted for its unique 6-degree spot metering capability its superb 7-element lens. It is a fantastic camera. It is a little bit heavier than some cameras.
Yeah.
It is small, though, and compact, which I find with a lot of Olympus cameras. I am an Olympus girl. I really like my Olympus cameras, so I would definitely give this camera a 5 out of 5 star rating. Definitely worth trying.
Yeah.
And a lot of fun.
Yeah, I use one myself, and although it doesn't come out that often,
it is definitely called.
Well, Olympus seems to have a way of making their cameras cult cameras.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly because most people were going, Canon, Nikon, yeah, Nikon.
Exactly.
It's like, hi, I'm Olympus. I make cameras that you will love.
I was looking through the viewfinder while Donna was talking, and that viewfinder is really, really...
It's really bright.
It's really good, and especially bright, for people with glasses that find it hard to use, it is actually... It's really good.
Now, the funny story is when we got this thing, the shutter blades were sticking. And anybody that knows me knows that sticking shutter blades means that it's a challenge. That's about it. So after learning on repairing a Canonet QL25, you can see my blog on how to repair that in the show notes. I basically followed the exact same idea with the Olympus 35SP. And sure enough, it came apart almost identical. So that just tells me that... probably in that era, the lenses were basically designed roughly the similar for just ease of use, I guess. And sure enough, exact same method I used to do the Canonet worked on the Olympus 35SP. Mm-hmm. And from a camera that went from being a decorator piece to a functional working shooter, sans the meter, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
I've used it a couple times, much to the chagrin of Donna, because she doesn't like sharing. And I must admit, I'm a little taken with this camera. I really like this Olympus camera. It's really good. So you know
we had quite a drive to go pick it up, but it was definitely worth.
Yeah, it was worth the drive to Lindsay. It's not often. Usually you hear it's worth the drive.
And the $25 as well, I might add.
Or as I like to say, Lindsay, the last bastion of civilization before the wild north of cottage country. If you could call Lindsay a bastion of civilization.
Well, this wasn't even in Lindsay. This was outside Lindsay.
Oh.
So, I mean, it was country. I mean, when we on our drive there, it was earlier this year. Toronto, no snow. We get out towards Oshawa, still no snow. Drive up towards Peterborough, Lindsay, and about 10 minutes north of the 401, lo and behold, the only place where there's snow. Go figure.
Hmm.
So, you know what?
North of Highway 9.
Yeah. So, I will definitely second Donna's praise on it. Yeah, definitely. 5 stars. Mm-hmm. I love this camera. Sadly, the meter doesn't work because I'd love to see how well the spot metering works. Yeah. And I know it uses an EV system, but all you have to do is look at the readout coming out on your lens.
Yeah.
It tells you your EV system your EV number that you're at as That's you adjust right. your shutter speed and adjust your aperture. Everything lines up.
Yeah.
Really simple to read. And yeah, no, fantastic camera, guys. If you get a chance to try one out.
Definitely.
The light meter is also always on when it's out of the case, which is a pretty neat feature as well.
Yeah.
It's always on?
It's always on when it's out of the case.
No. Then,
you'll want to make
sure... Battery makers love that.
You'll want to make sure that you have a lens cap.
Yeah.
For it.
Actually, it's not the... It's the meter, just so everybody knows, it's actually the meter's not TTL. It is not a TTL metering system.
No.
It, right beside the viewfinder, you will see a window... I'm almost positive.
Yes, that's the
that
meter.
Is the meter on it.
Yes, it
so
is.
So, if you have the ever ready case for it, or as we all like to call it, the never ready case, keep it in there. Or, unfortunately, black tape, also known as electrical tape.
So I'm just thinking for this the topic today, rangefinders. There's so many cameras that we could talk about.
Oh, there are.
Like we're saving like the Russian cameras. So you fed Zorky, Kiev fans, keep your powder dry. We'll have an episode for you guys. But they're ones we did. Like we talked about the Canonets by Canon briefly, but also things like the Konica Auto S2.
Oh, don't get me started on that camera.
Or the Yashica GSN 35.
Mm-hmm.
I find sometimes it can be a bit of a trick finding a working Yashica GSN 35. You do tend to pay a bit more for them.
Yep.
But a beautiful Yashinon lenses. There's Minolta examples that we talked about. They're just, it's a very popular segment of the market.
Yep, absolutely. Everyone wants a rangefinder.
Yep. No, you know what? Rangefinders, they're a great way to learn composition.
I think
that over an SLR for learning composition, probably the better way to go.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that it also teach you is what those little numbers on your lens mean. When you see the f-stop, and then you'll see, well, why is it there? I've got two numbers on the sides that say f4.5, and then beside it f5.6, and it's kind of on either side. That's your focal distance. That's
hyperfocal distance.
Good. Thank you.
Learn. Yeah.
So, for those that have no idea, take a look at your lens. You'll see it. And rangefinders, fantastic way to learn it.
Absolutely. And they're nice. They're small. They're compact. And they make a great camera for photo walks.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Unless you're crazy and bring a 4x5.
Been there, done that.
Yep. Yeah. Okay, so we've discussed what you need to develop film at home. We've discussed what you need to get a home darkroom. Now, we've alluded to this, that you need a developer chemistry. Now, there are a lot out there on the market, and of every single flavor and variety, and that's the one thing I like about black and white film photography, is that you can control your final look based on the film you use, how you filter it in the camera, what speed you shoot it, and what you develop it in. Now, developers come in two varieties. There's liquid, and there's powder. So, what do we all like in a developer? What's your favorite developer?
Well, I'd say, first of all, if you thought that people get worked up on arguing about Coke versus Pepsi, developer wars, this is one of those topics.
It's bigger than film versus digital.
Yes, I've seen people get so worked up. So when you research things online, you're going to see strong opinions.
Mm-hmm.
Say, this developer sucks, or I hate this stuff, or this is the only developer I use.
Yeah.
There's a lot of good information online, but at the end of the day, you need to try it yourself and see what you like.
Exactly.
Now, having said that, I'd say there are three or four developers that I use for different things. For example, Rodinal is a developer, probably one of the oldest formula that's still, probably along with Pyro.
Yep.
It goes back to almost like the turn of the 1900s. And it's a developer that you use very, very highly diluted. So it might be something like one part developer to 25 or 50 or even 100 parts.
200.
Of what? 200. The developer, it's not what's called a fine grain developer. So there are sort of two main kinds of developers. There are developers that will have a bit of what's called solvent action in them, to sort of smooth out the grain a little bit.
Yeah.
And these were very popular shooting 35 millimeter when you wanted to minimize grain. The price was sharpness.
Yeah.
Whereas Rodinal, it doesn't go out of its way to make film grainy, but it doesn't try and hide grain. So with Rodinal, you get very, very sharp results. So especially for like medium format, it's a beautiful developer. So it's Rodinal I like to use. I've also been trying PyroCat HD, which is a very, very old kind of developer, going back well into the 19th century.
Yeah.
And it's called a staining developer. It won't go into the... It could be a very long show.
Oh, yeah.
But it's also beautiful tonality. It's fun to work with. One other developer I'll mention, because there are a couple others I know that one of you guys will bring up for sure, is a special kind of developer called Diafine. And Diafine is actually a two-bath developer. So you put it in chemical A, then chemical B.
Never mix them.
And never mix them unless you want to buy new stuff.
Don't cross the streams.
And the great thing is it gives a speed increase with most films while still maintaining good grain. And unlike, like, developers, typically you either use what are called one-shot developers. You dilute them, use it, and you pour the developer down the sink. You use it once. Or there's what developers that you can use repeated times, but only a certain amount of times, like D76 stock.
And XTAL stock.
XTAL stock. You can use them a certain amount of times, and then they come exhausted. Diafine, theoretically, if you keep it sealed, my Diafine is...
It's going on 3 years.
Two and a half. It's 3 years old. If I look at the solution now, it looks and smells like the Humber River.
Oh.
If you live in Toronto and you've been to the Humber River, you know how vile that is.
I resemble that remark. Yeah. I live 5 minutes from the Humber, and it's nasty.
Yeah, the Humber River, let's just say if you fell in, you'd dissolve before you drowned.
Oh.
But so this stuff just keeps going and going and going. And so it's an amazing, like it's sort of special purpose. Don't use it every day.
Yeah.
But for, let's say, if I need to push a film and get speed, like Tri-X, I shoot it like 800 to 1,000. It is the go-to magic juice for that kind of thing. So those are the ones that I tend to use the most.
Okay. I've played around with a lot of developers. And again, it's just a simple matter of doing that and finding the one that you like. The ones that I use mostly these days, there's PMK Pyro, which is an older formulation of PyroCAD HD. Mm-hmm. I really like doing Tri-X in that.
Oh, your results with the Pyro and Tri-X are phenomenal.
Absolutely.
Especially your 4x5 stuff.
And the nice thing about Pyro is that where in some developers you have to trade sharpness and grain, or fine grain and less sharpness, Pyro gives you both.
Yes, it does.
I've found. Yeah. Absolutely. But you do get a loss of speed. You do get a loss of speed, and you are looking at fairly long developing times. I've never found anything really under 7.5 minutes.
I find also even with Rodinal, it's a speed loss developer too.
Yeah. Another one that I'm a big fan of, and I keep this in a 5-liter gas can, is XTAL. XTAL, I will always dilute it 1:1. It's generally my go-to one. I really like Akros 100. It's pretty much the only developer other than PMK Pyro that Akros will look good in my opinion.
In your opinion, yes.
In my opinion.
Rodinal.
I've tried it in Rodinal. I don't like the grain.
Careful. You might start a war over putting grain emulsions in Rodinal.
And he's got wars. Weapons.
For those of you that do not feel comfortable using chemicals, again, I have talked about coffee. You can also use coffee as a developer. It is safe and not smelly.
But hands down, my favorite developer is HC110.
Oh, now, yeah. Bravo.
HC110 is an interesting animal. It sort of fell in under the radar when it first came out. And a lot of people are sort of weirded out because all of a sudden you're like, what's dilution A? What's dilution B? And I have to mix this syrup with water to make this stock solution and all that. It's not that hard. Like we were mentioning, you can either mix it up from a pint bottle into a stock solution and then dilute it to B, etc., etc. If you look online, the Kodak material sheets have the dilutions that you need there. Once you know that ratio, you can easily calculate it. Or what I've started doing is I've actually started mixing it directly from the syrup. It lasts a lot longer, and you just need a medical syringe to pull it up. And it just, and I just love doing it. Tri-X in my F4, in HC110, dilution B for 4.5 minutes, and the results are absolute magical. And one of the developers that has just recently come into my chemistry closet is T-Max Developer. Again, it was designed for their T-grain emulsions, but I actually really, really like using it with Plus X and Tri-X. It just gives fantastic results. It's sharp. You get a bit of grain, but it's a pleasing grain when you look at it. So, and again, it's a liquid, and you can dilute it either 1:4, 1:9, or if you're crazy, 1:19.
I've done it.
Yes, we know.
You're crazy.
it's funny, we all, as we're talking this, we all have our favorites. We're all sort of, Yeah. There's no video, so you can't see the expressions on our faces. When, like I'm not an HD110 fan. I just need to use it more. But people say, oh, film is dead, film is dying.
No.
There's just so many options and things to try. Like even like the coffee, and which probably like the caffeinol, as it's called, that Don, you were alluding to. You know, there are recipes online. It's basically you get the, what I like about it, it's in a way it's perverse. You get the cheapest, crummiest instant coffee.
And it works fantastic.
And washing soda, a bit of vitamin C, depending on the formulation.
And a lot of people just think the word chemicals. Oh, no, chemicals. Yeah. So there is a different way. Coffee.
Yeah. You can buy, I'd much recommend this, is the Eco Developer, which is an ascorbic acid developer, which is
very similar to Extol.
Yeah, and it is, it's basically just vitamin C, which is fantastic.
Also used in the creation of caffeinol C recipe, will have your instant coffee, your washing soda, and your vitamin C powder.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And these are things you can pick up at a health food store,
grocery store,
and a pool supply store.
Yep.
You get shock for your shock for your pool will act as the washing soda agent in it.
Nice.
There's a website dedicated to caffeinol. I've done a lot of work with caffeinol. Actually, I found that Akros responds really well to caffeinol with expensive instant coffee. Yeah.
I developed Ilford SFX and caffeinol.
There we go.
In fact, the from a previous episode, the AGFA Sure Shot, the Ilford SFX that I put through it, I developed in caffeinol, and the results are stunning. Mm. As you can see from the previous show notes, it's just fantastic. I'm really, really impressed with caffeinol. A lot of people will swear to use it one shot. Maybe my solution was wrong. I don't know, but I kid you not, 18 months later, still working. However, I dumped it for one reason. I could no longer fill a single roll 35mm stainless steel tank. So because it got that low in the bottle, I had to mix new solution. And I really believe that it was getting a little too strong in the fact that I think it was rebelling in the bottle. It was really nasty smelling.
Yeah, caffeinol does not smell good.
No. Whoever thought that something as wonderful smelling as coffee can smell as nasty as caffeinol?
So, we're talking about all these. Like, there are literally hundreds of developers.
Yeah.
Massive dev chart.
Yes.
Google it.
Get their app. Everything. It makes your film developing so easy.
But I guess the flip side with all this choice is, if you're a beginning film developer, where do you start? Because
D76.
I'd say D76. So Extol is, in some ways, meant to be a somewhat more ecologically friendly updated. So I'd say D76, Extol, sort of a good sort of neutral starting point.
Ilfasol 3, another really good
Ilfasol
one.
Ilfasol 3 was my very first developer that I used when I got back in. I initially started with, of course, D76. Ilford's version is called ID11. Mm-hmm. And again, we've mostly talked about Kodak, EGFA, and older developers here, but Ilford makes a fantastic line of developers as well. It's something that I've been exploring over the course of this year.
I love Ilfasol 3. I mean, they recommended 1+9, but I've been using it diluted 1+14.
Yep.
Absolutely love Ilfasol 3. I've been heckled many times by certain people about not having Extol in my regime of developers.
Well, no one's perfect.
And using Ilfasol 3, but I must admit, recently I did buy a packet of Extol, and it might get mixed up sometime in the very near future. So we'll see. We'll see. Yeah. So it's March. I've still got the summer to get into it.
And another really cool thing and another great site, it's called The Unblinking Eye.
Ooh, never heard of that one.
They actually have ingredients on how to mix up your own D76. You can also get the older Kodak D23 mixed up.
I've mixed D23.
And even some print developers that you can still mix up. Ansel Adams' favorite was Ansco 130. And you can find, and you can actually still buy from Photographer's Formulary the
raw chemistry materials. Now, being in Canada, we might have a bit of a hard time shipping it across the border, especially if it's liquid powder. It's okay.
ORMD, guys. Pay attention to that.
I mean, New York City's not that far away. It's about an 8-hour drive.
Yeah.
And you can always run down to B&H and pick up the chemistry and bring it back. Just don't say anything at the border and don't tell anyone that I told you to do that.
Well, it's just a box of white powder. What could possibly go wrong?
Exactly. I have a few more tricks, but I'm not going to share them on air.
Well, not everybody has a pickup truck with two gas tanks. Come on.
I'd say start off something like D76.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or the one of the equivalents, or Xtol.
D76 is great because it's cheap.
Yeah.
Yep.
Right? It's cheap.
$7 a bag.
You get it. It comes in a 1 gallon or 3.8 liters because we are Canadian.
3.785 to be exact.
Close enough.
Close enough for black and white.
Exactly. And you can either use it stock, straight out of the bottle, don't have to worry about any sort of math, or dilute it 1-to-1. And it produces fantastic results across a lot of films. And once you get that down, you can start exploring more. Again, it all comes down to personal taste.
And remember HC-110, Ansel Adams' favorite. So,
yeah.
When you're done with the D76, if you really like it, by all means, go with it. You want to try another one? HC-110. Absolutely. Yep. I highly recommend it.
Ilfasol 3, HC-110, Rodinol.
Awesome. If you want to try something else, Arista has some wonderful lines of film developers, mm-hmm. and they're based off of similar ones, such yep. as LC, the Arista LC, or is it Legacy Pro LC, which is actually HC-110, but instead of it being a syrup that you can walk on, it's a thin liquid.
Yeah.
But it is mixed exactly the same. Makes it easier to mix up.
What I found for me is that for certain films, like there's some developers I stock just for one film.
Yes.
Yep.
For me now, I've decided that when I shoot Delta 3200, I develop it in DDX.
Really? I haven't used DDX, but I've heard really fantastic. Good things.
It's not cheap.
No, it's
that's
not.
That's why I just use it. It's reserved for Delta 3200. And although I can be guilty of it too, sometimes you can get hung up on developer mania. And if you have this wall of chemicals and it's like this mad scientist laboratory in your dark room. There's something to be said for at least at the beginning, sticking with one or two developers, really getting your process and your fastidiousness and your predictability and repeatability.
Consistency, under consistency, control, consistency, consistency.
And as opposed to just rolling the dice every time and say, wow, I got images this time.
Yeah.
Because there is nothing worse than taking shots that are important to you.
Yeah.
And open the reel and
it's blank.
It's blank.
We've been there.
Yeah.
For one reason or another, it hurts.
Yep. That's one thing you can't get with digital is that sinking feeling that you get nothing but a clear piece of acetate.
Yes. Like I said, film photography has a way of keeping you humble.
Absolutely.
Yep. Absolutely.
You gotta get your processes down.
Yeah. I have a bottle of Microdol X mixed up that I still need to finish off.
Okay. Oh, yeah. I can't say much about the Microdol. I tried it. Maybe I did something wrong, but after...
Did you dilute it?
Yeah, you know what? Maybe that was what I did wrong.
Microdol X is one of those developers. Most developers, you can get good results with diluting it. Microdol X is not one of those.
Yeah, I diluted it. 45 minutes later, still nothing.
Yeah.
Beat that. 45 minutes and nothing.
I tried 1-3 once. I had some...
That's what I did. 1-3.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
It's one of those things where you can get two different people use the same developer, same film, and get different results.
Mm-hmm.
Phase of the moon, the quality of your water. It's the kind of thing where you have to do your own testing and don't get hung up on people who feel they have that they're speaking the truth, capital T, online about certain developers.
Yeah, I tried with SO331. Mm-hmm. I think I exposed it for ASA25 or ISO25 or EI25, whatever you want to call it. Ran it through the camera, developed it in Microdol because I've heard really good things about using Microdol for slower speed films. Tried it out. And sure enough, 45 minutes later, still nothing. And I did a clip test just to make sure. I tried everything I could. I even tried adding some HC-110 to try to bring up the contrast for some weird reason. Maybe it was just my luck with that film. I just didn't get anything. It was really, really unfortunate. It hurts. But I have had success once with SO-331. But maybe I did something wrong because the amount of contrast, I was so sad. It was almost like looking at Kotalith. It was just
that's the kind of film it is. We shoot some weird film on this show.
Yes, we do.
Yeah. Well, when they say black and white, black and white.
We're going to be talking more about films later on once we finish off with all this nitty gritty, getting gear. We'll start talking about the films that we know and love, which might raise some arguments as well.
Yes, I agree.
Well, speaking of other developers, Rodinal, one thing, I've been working a lot with Rodinal. On Twitter, I used to tweet out about the Church of Rodinal. One of the things that I must try to emphasize is when you use it, it is not a developer that you agitate. It is 1 to 2 very, very gentle agitations every minute.
Mm-hmm.
Do it too much, guaranteed grain.
Yep.
Do it very, very gently. Yep. And because it is such a good developer, such tiny dilutions go a long way. Yep. And
one other note about Rodinal, you can still find bottles of Rodinal around.
Yep.
They'll still be good. The stuff keeps for almost ever. But if you're buying new stuff, you won't find the Rodinal name, simply because that patent has run out. So EGFA produces something called R09 One-Shot, same stuff. Here in Canada, we get stuff called Blazinol, same stuff.
You can get R09, and you can basically get almost any inception of Rodinol in Canada.
ADOX is called Adenol.
Yeah.
So again, same animal.
There are even people, I have not tried it or read into it, but there are people who can take acetaminophen.
I've seen it. Yep.
Wow. Really?
I had the recipe to do it. And apparently the acetaminophen version lasts for about 6 months.
Yeah.
And after 6 months, it's kind of dump it. So, and it does take a fair number of acetaminophen tablets, but if your local supplier does not have any form of Rodinal and you really, really want some and you can't ship it because of ORMD, acetaminophen, it's pretty much available anywhere. You can get the recipe online. We'll see if we can link it in our show notes. And absolutely, try it out. You'll like it. It's Rodinal's really fantastic.
I can make a philosophical observation. So, in a world of where like digital cameras go obsolete in 2 years, isn't it neat that we can talk about developers that are 120 years old or more, and still get results with them?
Absolutely.
I think that's neat.
Yeah.
That is absolutely fantastic.
Hi, it's John here. If you're in the Toronto area between April 10th and April 24th, I'd like to invite you to my photography exhibit called The Silver Path. These are all film photographs taken, developed by myself, and printed in my darkroom. The show will be located in the offices of the Investors Group, Suite 300, 1 Yorkdale Road. This is in the Yorkdale Shopping Center. The opening reception is on Friday, April the 10th, between 7 and 9:30. There'll be all sorts of fun things happening that evening, so you're certainly invited. For more information on the show, please go to my photo blog, which is johnmeadowsphotography.com, and look for the link for The Silver Path. Or you can send me an email if you have any questions, jgmeadows@gmail.com. So I'd love to see you there. Thank you.
We're off for another episode. We'll be back next month. In the meantime, connect with us. We're on Facebook, Classic Camera Revival, or send us an email, classiccamerarevival@gmail.com.
Or you can even catch us on Twitter.
Yep, we are. And I don't actually remember the handle offhand, but just look for Classic Camera Revival and give us a follow.
Okay. Keep shooting.
Keep the film rolling.
Keep them shutters firing.
The name Voigtlander in photography goes back actually to before print, before photography itself. There's a firm, I think, like back to like something like the 1700s. I'll look it up. In the Voigtlander camera, not as expensive as the Leica. okay, I'll save that for the end.